Conference recording started.
Good afternoon and welcome to the ADA Legal Webinar. Today's session is Criminal Justice and the ADA. Our presenters are Barry Taylor and Rachel Weisberg from Equip for Equality. I'd like to hand the microphone over to Rachel at this time.
Thank you, Claudia, and hello and good afternoon to everyone. Welcome to today's legal webinar. We're really looking forward to our discussion today focused on criminal justice issues in the ADA. This is, of course, a timely and very important issue. I wanted to start by giving a roadmap of today's presentation. I'm going to start and give some background and an overview of the relevant laws, and then we're really going to delve into some case law about ADA and police interactions or law enforcement. And then depending on the time, we may or may not take a short break for questions. And then I'm going to pass the presentation over to Barry, who's going to finish up by talking about the ADA and correctional facilities, the ADA and reentry issues, the ADA and criminal proceedings like court cases, and then of course we're going to open the floor again for some questions at the end. I also wanted to make a plug. Claudia mentioned it earlier, but in addition to the PowerPoint presentation, we've put together a comprehensive legal brief that talks not only about the cases we'll be discussing during today's webinar, but some additional cases as well. So if that's something that's of interest, you can download that from the website www.ada-legal.org. Before we delve in, I wanted to remind folks that Illinois attorneys are able to obtain CLE credit from today's presentation. If you're interested in obtaining the 1.5 hours of CLE, please contact Barry Taylor at barryt@equipforequality.org. Participants who are not attorneys who are looking for continuing education credit should contact the Great Lakes ADA Center at 877-232-1990 or webinars at ada-audio.org. And this slide will be repeated at the end. Okay, so let's get started with some background and an overview of the relevant laws. So of course, in the world that we live in, criminal justice is a very important, critical issue. The discussion about criminal justice issues is really everywhere. We see it on the news media and political campaigns. There's discussions throughout government entities and local communities. And these discussions are all, of course, exceptionally important. But what we don't always see in these public discussions is a real focus on disability. And what we found is that people with disabilities often encounter the criminal justice system more frequently than people without disabilities. And there's some recent statistics about that. And so given the vast importance of this issue and the frequent encounters, it's of course essential for all of us to understand the applicable federal laws that are going to apply to the criminal justice system. So that's exactly what we're going to do today. We're going to talk about these federal laws. We're going to talk about the ADA and the rehabilitation. If we have time at the end, we're going to do a very short segment on the U.S. Constitution. And we really want to emphasize that criminal justice is a broad category. And so we're going to touch on the issues that we've seen most in the case law. But the four issues, you know, as I mentioned before, the four topics, the big topics we're going to talk about today are law enforcement, correctional facilities, reentry planning, and criminal court proceedings. Okay, so which federal laws apply? Well, this is an ADA legal webinar, so not surprisingly, the ADA is one of the laws that applies. And of course, we're going to be looking at Title II of the ADA. Title II, of course, is the title that applies to programs, services, and activities of state and local governments. And generally, when we're talking about policing and correctional facilities, those are all programs of state and local governments. The other applicable law is Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act. As most know, Section 504 applies to entities that receive federal funding, so that's going to apply to most of those entities as well. But really, as a practical matter, all of these entities that are involved in the criminal justice system are both state and local entities and entities that receive federal funding. So as a practical matter, both the ADA and the Rehabilitation Act are going to apply. So my question for everyone to think about before we go on to the next slide is, which law or laws do you think apply to facilities and programs that are managed by the federal government, such as federal prisons? Does everyone have their answer? So the answer is, of course, the Rehabilitation Act. Title II of the ADA does not extend to federal entities, so that's not going to be an applicable law. But the Rehabilitation Act does cover certain federal programs. What's important to know is that it covers the executive branch, and so that means that if we have a federal prison, that's going to be covered by the Rehabilitation Act. However, federal courts are actually outside the scope of the Rehabilitation Act because it's a judicial branch, and so while they've imposed some of their own discrimination requirements, it's not actually protected. The federal courts are not actually within the scope of the Rehabilitation Act or the ADA. Okay, so now we know what laws apply. What do these laws do? Well, this is going to be a quick reminder because most of this is the same kind of information that applies no matter what we're talking about as long as it's covered by the ADA or the Rehabilitation Act. There's, of course, general non-discrimination requirements that require equal access to programs, services, and activities to people with disabilities, your general non-discrimination provisions. And then we've got more specific non-discrimination requirements. And this is when we recognize that to provide equal access, sometimes we need to go above and beyond basic non-discrimination. And so that's where we get to the provisions in the ADA and the Rehabilitation Act saying, well, covered entities need to provide auxiliary aids and services necessary to ensure effective communication. It's where we get the specific requirement that we have to make reasonable modifications of policy if doing so would enable the access of people with disabilities. We need to provide legally required architectural and programmatic access, and we need to provide programs and services in the most integrated setting available. So these terms, as applied to everything that the ADA covers, what does this mean in each area of criminal justice? Well, that's what we're really going to talk about today as we go through program by program. So the first big program we're going to talk about is ADA and law enforcement, or ADA and police encounters. And the critical preliminary issue before we even talk about this is, does the ADA even apply to law enforcement? Does it apply in all aspects of law enforcement? And does it apply to arrests? And according to the Department of Justice, which is a federal agency that enforces the ADA, enforces Title II of the ADA, has always said yes, of course it does. It's the DOJ's position, and it's been their longstanding position, that the ADA and Title II applies to this law enforcement in nearly every facet of their work. There's a laundry list of activities that they say that the ADA applies to, including interrogating witnesses, booking, holding suspects, enforcing laws, operating 911 centers, and notably, arrests. This is a position that was, I think, first articulated in 1991 when the Department of Justice issued some commentary to the regulations. It's something that's been reiterated. There's a great ADA guidance document that DOJ put out in 2006 about the ADA and law enforcement, and it's a position that was articulated just as recently as a couple of months ago when DOJ filed a statement of interest in a case called Robinson versus Farley. In the Robinson case, DOJ gives a lot of explanation about why the ADA is going to apply to all aspects of policing, including arrests. What DOJ says is that, you know, that Title II is a broad law. It applies to all programs, services, and activities, and policing and arrests are clearly programs, activities, and services of a state and local government. DOJ actually delves into the legislative history and finds specific comments made when the ADA was being debated and passed, referencing its application towards arrests. And then DOJ notes that most courts who have considered this issue also say yes. The Title II of the ADA is going to apply to arrests. So for those who are interested in looking and reading more, we've got a link to that statement of interest on this slide. However, despite DOJ's strong position on this issue, there is a current dispute in the courts. So one of the first circuits and the first cases to analyze this issue is this Haynes case that came out of the Fifth Circuit. What happened in the Haynes case is that a woman had a nephew who she felt was she needed a little assistance to transport him to the hospital for mental health treatment. So she called 911. She asked for help transporting her nephew, who was Mr. Haynes. And during that call, she told the cops, you know, that Mr. Haynes had threatened suicide, or a concept called suicide by cop, where he wanted to kind of provoke the cops to the point that they would then kill him. And she also put the cops on notice that Mr. Haynes was under the influence of alcohol and antidepressant drugs and had a knife. So lo and behold, the police arrive. They see Mr. Haynes. They see that he's not wearing shoes and that he has a knife and that he's talking to people in the trunk, in a truck. So the officers drew their weapons. They ordered Haynes to walk away. But Haynes did not walk away. He responded with profanities and he actually walked toward the officer. Again, he was ordered to stop. He did not stop. And when he was about 4 to 6 feet from the officers shot him twice, but he survived. And this entire encounter took only about 20 seconds. So the case went all the way up to the Fifth Circuit, and the question was, you know, whether or not there was any sort of requirement for the police to modify their typical policing practices, given the fact that this individual had a mental illness and the officers were aware. And the Fifth Circuit said, you know, we're not even going to get to that question, because the way we see it, the ADA does not apply to situations where an officer is on the street responding to a reported disturbance, so long as it's before the officer has secured the scene and before he can ensure that there's no threat to human life. So let me pause for a second and make sure that I'm very clear about what this is saying. The court's not saying that the plaintiffs just didn't prove their case. The court's not saying that the ADA doesn't apply to this specific situation because the police proved a fundamental alteration or other sort of defense. They're just saying that the ADA does not apply at all. There's a categorical exception for these certain arrests before the scene is secured. And the reason that the Fifth Circuit made this decision is that they said that law enforcement faces this onerous task of having to instantaneously identify, assess, react to potentially life-threatening situations. And so it would pose an unnecessary risk to innocents to require officers to comply with the ADA in the presence of these exigent circumstances before they secure the scene. Congress couldn't intend this result, and, you know, the court says, well, and also there's other remedies for relief. There's constitutional claims, there's state law claims, and so it's not like plaintiffs have no other option. So this is the rule that the Haynes case established. Other courts have been following it. It's something that we've seen throughout the case law. That said, it's certainly the minority rule, and by that I mean most courts that have analyzed this issue have found that Title II does indeed apply to arrests. But the issue of the exigent circumstances is certainly one that does still factor in. And so what most courts are saying is that we got to do a typical ADA analysis. And like everything else in the ADA, we got to use this reasonableness test. And so here, when we're analyzing whether or not the police acted reasonably, we're going to take these exigent circumstances into account as part of that reasonableness analysis, but we're not going to create this categorical exception like the Haynes case said. And so we've got two examples in this slide, the Burkle case and the Waller case, that really talk about, well, we got to look at the reasonableness of the issue, not so much whether it's categorically exempt. So you've heard me say that there's a majority rule and a minority rule. And so what that means is we've got a circuit split. We have some courts saying one thing and some courts saying something else. And so what frequently happens when we have a circuit split is that it's an issue that's sometimes ripe for Supreme Court review to make a final determination. And that's what we thought we were going to get. A couple of years ago, the Supreme Court agreed to hear a case exactly about this issue, about the ADA's application to arrest. And this was the Sheehan case that folks may be aware of. We've got Ms. Sheehan, who has schizoaffective disorder and lives in a group home. She was working with a social worker and had been threatening to kill the social worker, and so the social worker contacted the police to seek help in transferring her to either a hospital or somewhere else for some more intensive mental health treatment. What happened was the officers arrived and they used a key to immediately go into her home, into her room. And she responded with some threats of violence, and so the officers backed up and called for backup. But then instead of waiting for the backup, they decided that she may be unstable and might harm herself. So they immediately re-entered her room, tried to pepper spray her, which didn't work, and then she approached them with a knife. And so in that moment, the officers decided that there was nothing else to do besides to shoot Ms. Sheehan. They did. She survived. So then we have the same sort of case where she comes forward and says that this is a violation of the ADA. The police knew she had a mental health disability and that they should have accommodated her disability. Specifically, what they should have done is not forced the reentry into her room, and because of her mental illness, they should have engaged in less violent tactics. They should have engaged in non-threatening communications, used the passage of time to diffuse the situation, instead of engaging in deadly force. So this court, the first level goes to a trial court, and the trial court looked to that Haynes case we just talked about and said, you know what, the ADA does not apply at all. This was an exigent situation with exigent circumstances. The ADA is not going to apply. Well, the case went up to the Ninth Circuit, and the Ninth Circuit actually found for Ms. Sheehan. They reversed and remanded the decision, and they said, no, we disagree with that Haynes decision. The ADA is broad. Title II is broad. It applies to anything a public entity does. But these specific exigent circumstances are, of course, important, but they really are more to inform us of the reasonableness of the police actions. And so here, the ADA is going to apply. And then the court went even further and evaluated the case on its merits and said, you know, a reasonable jury could have found that there should have been modifications of policy made. You know, when the police arrived, the situation had already been somewhat diffused, and it was definitely, you know, it could have been reasonable to employ these less confrontational tactics, such as waiting for a backup. So, you know, the Ninth Circuit made that decision, and then San Francisco appealed the case all the way to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court decided to hear the argument specifically about whether the ADA requires law enforcement officers to provide accommodations to arm violent and people with disabilities with mental illness specifically kind of during these situations of potential imminent harm. So we thought we were going to get an answer and an end to this circuit split. But what happened next was kind of bizarre. San Francisco, the defendant in this case, when they went to the Supreme Court, actually changed their argument before the court. And instead of arguing that, you know, they were not liable because of this categorical exemption that Haynes offered, instead they made a more substantive argument on the merits and said that Ms. Sheehan posed a direct threat and that she wasn't qualified. So that argument hadn't been certified for review by the court. It wasn't an argument that had really been briefed by the parties. And so the Supreme Court said, you know, this claim was improvidently granted. It's not something we can decide. Based on that, the kind of the practical where does this leave us question answer is that the Ninth Circuit case in Sheehan is still good law in that circuit, but the Supreme Court didn't provide any further clarity to resolve the circuit split or decide whether or not the Haynes case is still good law. A DOJ also filed an amicus brief in that case, and there's a link at the bottom of the slide. Okay, so we're going to turn to an analysis of these exigent circumstances and really see how this plays out in practice. And that's what the Williams case discusses, as well as discussing issues related to law enforcement's interactions with people who are deaf and hard of hearing. This Williams case is a great example of, yes, we care about exigent circumstances, but we can't overly rely on them and just use them as a way not to provide accommodations. So this case, the facts are a little bit tricky, but essentially there was the plaintiff was the owner of a home, and she and her husband were both deaf. They had tenants that they had somewhat of a not great relationship with, and they were planning to evict the tenants from their property. And so the plaintiff and their husband started to do this. There was a slight altercation. One of the tenant's boyfriends kind of made a move suggesting that perhaps he had a knife. And based on that, the plaintiff's husband, through their video relay service, called the police. The police arrive on the scene, and despite requests to do so, do not obtain an ASL interpreter. And then there were even offers by the one individual there who was hearing, who knew sign language, to help interpret, but the police declined that too. And ultimately, the only thing that the police did was interviewed the one individual there who was able to commute orally and was hearing, and didn't really interview the witness or the plaintiff or the plaintiff's husband. Based on that, the police ultimately arrested the plaintiff for assault and held her overnight. Now, during any of this communication, there was no interpreter provided. No one told Ms. Williams, the plaintiff, why she was arrested or how long she'd be in custody. And so what happened next? Well, the plaintiff brought a lawsuit under a number of different laws and constitutional provisions, state law provisions, and the ADA. And what happened in defense, the New York Police Department, they cited the Haynes case, but they went even above and beyond. They said that the ADA doesn't apply until after an individual has been arrested and booked, even if doing so could have easily been accomplished without endangering public safety. Well, as you can probably expect, the court absolutely rejected this argument, called it an extraordinary argument, and found that the ADA was going to apply. So the NYPD also argued that it was unreasonable to provide an accommodation in this case because they needed to secure the scene. Well, I know the facts were a little bit confusing, but when the police arrived, there was nothing to suggest that anyone was in imminent harm. There was no gun, no one had really any physical altercations, and so it was not like a situation where someone was violent and threatening. And so the court said, well, maybe if there were these exigent circumstances, but those don't exist here. Here, there was no one in any imminent danger, and so we can't overly rely on this exigent circumstances reasonableness test. So following that decision, the case did settle. It settled for $750,000, which was, again, these constitutional, state law, and ADA claims. But we want to compare that to another case where the court found that exigent circumstances did preclude the provision of an interpreter. In the Burkle case, which is out of the 11th Circuit, we have a plaintiff who was deaf, and he was pulled over on suspicion of drunk driving. Once he was pulled over, he was at first administered field sobriety test and then ultimately taken to the police station for a breathalyzer test. On both occasions, he asked for an oral interpreter. This particular individual did not use sign language, but he had asked for an oral interpreter, and that request was denied. So what the court did was look at whether or not providing an oral interpreter was a reasonable modification in both of these situations. So starting with the DUI stop on the side of the highway, the court said that no, waiting for an oral interpreter was not going to be a reasonable modification due to the exigent circumstances. The court cited that when you have this DUI stop here on the side of the highway, police have to make on-the-spot judgment, there's some serious safety concerns, and as a practical matter, if the point was to, you know, check the plaintiff's blood alcohol level, and waiting would have altered those results. The court then went one step further and said, you know, in addition to the fact that there's really no exigent circumstances, the communication here was effective because in addition to being provided with these verbal instructions, the police officers gave physical demonstrations and the plaintiff admitted that he could understand. And I think what was also relevant to this case is that this particular plaintiff, his primary mode of communication was through lip reading. Although he said he only understood about 50% of the communications when he was lip reading. So then the next question is, okay, well, maybe there's exigent circumstances present when you're on the side of a highway, but what about when you're at a police station? And the court said there the exigent circumstances still exist. They still needed to take this breathalyzer test, and waiting would have altered the blood alcohol level exam. The court also explained that, yes, there was no oral interpreter, but the plaintiff was given a consent form to read that explained everything about the breathalyzer, and the plaintiff had, you know, had gone to college and could read, write, and speak English. And yes, the communication was important, but it was a short one, and it was not a complex one. And so, based on that, they found that there was no need to have provided an interpreter. And like the Burkle case, and like a lot of cases that we see that really are about effective communication, some of the cases also turn on whether the perceived effectiveness of the communication. And so in the Valenzuolo case out of Connecticut is a good example of that. Here we have an individual who was arrested for failing to appear in court. He was not provided with an interpreter either during his arrest or during interactions with law enforcement after his arrest. What happened here is that this individual had a pen and paper that he always used to communicate when someone appeared at his house. And so he had actually had previous interactions with the police in this case. And so the court, it was actually a bench trial. The court looked at those factors and said, you know, this individual commonly uses a pen and paper to communicate. During his initial arrest, he used a pen and paper to communicate. He had communicated with that method previously. He was able to read, and he had read the arrest warrant. He actually ended up passing out when he was arrested, and so he was brought to a hospital. And then during the course of the time at the hospital, he had communicated via written notes on a number of pages in complete sentences, proper spelling, and so the court found that to be instructive when determining whether or not the communication was effective. So it's a good reminder for plaintiffs out there, of course, to show why sometimes written note is not an effective means of communication, even if an individual is able to read and write. So of course, the Department of Justice has been extremely active in its enforcement efforts regarding effective communication in law enforcement, especially with respect to interactions with individuals who are deaf and hard of hearing. We want to spend a little time going through one of the most recent settlement agreements, which is a resolution that was reached in May of this year with the City of Columbia and the South Carolina Police Department. This is a case or a settlement agreement that was reached after a complainant said that he wasn't provided with an interpreter for police questioning over a 3-month period. And it's really a great comprehensive agreement, and it's a good template for law enforcement agencies to use when evaluating their own policies. So some of the highlights of this agreement include that the police department is going to designate at least one employee to be the ADA coordinator. They're going to revise their policies to make sure that they're providing appropriate auxiliary aids and services, including sign language interpreters, and they're going to have some revised training requirements. But in addition to those kind of general provisions, the agreement gets into some great detail about how are they going to actually do that. And what the agreement does is it requires the police department to come up with certain protocols. So on slide 30, we have an example of these communication cards. The Department of Justice has two examples of communication cards that are supposed to be used in interactions where there's no immediate threat, and it's a routine interaction out in the field. And there's two images on this slide. One has a number of common violations. So for instance, there's one where it asks for a license, registration, insurance information, so the officer could point and explain to the individual what they need. And then there's images showing speeding, stop sign, no seatbelt, reckless driving, red light, broken tailgate, DUI, caution sign, and then an image that looks potentially like jail, so maybe it was an arrest warrant. And there's also a second communication card that's supposed to be used that actually says the best way to communicate with me is, and there's six images, an interpreter, captioning, writing, lip reading, a sign saying I cannot lip read, and then an assistive listening device. And so again, it's a way to have it's a way to have these communications out in the field when there's no imminent threat during a routine interaction. The DOJ settlement also says that the police department should be using pictograms to determine if someone needs an interpreter in, again, all non-exigent circumstances. In this, there's a sign, an interpreter sign, and then there's actually text that says sign language interpreter, and then the sign language, the sign for yes and the sign for no. And so it's something that can be used, again, to make sure that every time this is presented to someone who's deaf or hard of hearing, there's a clear discussion about whether or not the individual needs and wants a sign language interpreter. And then finally, another aspect of the DOJ agreement says that when people with disabilities are taken into custody for processing, the police department needs to use a particular form to determine what the appropriate auxiliary aid or service is. And so DOJ put out a sample form that asks questions about the nature of your disability, asks if you're deaf, if you're hard of hearing, if you have a speech impairment, asks if you need an on-site professional sign language interpreter or oral interpreter, and specifies that this is provided free of charge, and then also asks about whether other accommodations would be helpful, also specifying that those are provided free of charge. And those other accommodations are things like TTY, assistive listening device, note takers, or writing. So with all three of these forms, what DOJ did is gave samples and then told the police department to either adopt those or come up with their own and get DOJ approval. But there are, again, these great tools that can be used to make sure that the communication needs are being assessed and individuals' communication needs are being adequately addressed. The other thing that's helpful in this DOJ agreement is this issue of exigent circumstances that we've talked about throughout this webinar so far. And it has specific provisions giving us guidance about what to do when there are exigent circumstances. And what this agreement says is that it's okay to use what's available when you're actually in the field and if it's consistent with an appropriate law enforcement response when there are these exigent circumstances. So exchanging written notes, even if it's not something that's preferred, if there are exigent circumstances, it may be okay. The same thing with using someone who isn't a qualified interpreter but knows sign language. When you're in the field, if there's exigent circumstances, maybe it's okay. But DOJ is very clear, and the settlement's very clear, that this is an interim period only during the immediate threat. And then the second that immediate threat is over, the police department needs to follow their procedure to provide the appropriate auxiliary aid and service, including the interpreters. Other aspects of the settlement are that the department's going to actually either have a contract or maintain some sort of relationship with qualified language interpreting, sign language interpreting agencies to make sure that interpreters are available on a priority basis. And in most cases, during normal business hours, that's going to mean a one-hour turnaround. And recognizing that outside of normal business hours, it may be a little longer, but they want it to still be reasonable. The agreement shows that you need to modify handcuffing policies by handcuffing individuals in the front of their body to enable sign language or writing. Also says that that the police department's going to ensure a sufficient number of working TTYs and video phones and provide signage to inform the community about all of these accommodations and their availability. So again, a really comprehensive, helpful agreement that is a good resource for police departments out there evaluating their communication policies. Okay, we're going to turn now to some cases that are primarily about excessive force. And these are cases that are typically brought under various constitutional provisions, but a lot of them also include ADA claims. And some of those ADA claims are both a failure to provide proper training about interacting with people with disabilities, a failure to modify typical policing policies when it's necessary to do so for people with disabilities. And so this failure to modify concept is, of course, similar to the ones we talked about in the Haynes and Sheehan case, but we're going to talk about a couple more. And the first one I'm going to discuss is a case that many people may be familiar with. It's an extremely tragic case, a tragic outcome that really occurred all because these police were refusing to make simple modifications. And this is a State of Saylor versus Regal Cinemas case out of Maryland from 2 years ago. So what happened is that Mr. Saylor was a 26-year-old man with Down syndrome, an avid movie theater goer, and he went to the movie with his personal aide, and after he left the movie, he entered the theater without paying for an additional ticket. So three off-duty county sheriffs, they were working as security guards, and they spoke to Mr. Saylor's aide about the situation and said, you know, he went back into this movie theater, he didn't pay. And the aide explains, you know, Mr. Saylor's disability and just said, you know, let's just wait. He doesn't like to be approached. Can we either wait for me to address it or wait for his mom to come? It will be soon. She can address it. The officers, despite this advice, disregarded it, and instead they approached Mr. Saylor. They started an entire confrontation. They said he needed to leave. He refused. They then grabbed his arms, dragged him from the theater while yelling he was going to go to jail. And he was heard, you know, screaming for his mom. The officers ended up handcuffing Mr. Saylor. One was on top of him, and ultimately they fractured his larynx, making it difficult to breathe, and Mr. Saylor died. So really, a tragic, tragic situation. Mr. Saylor's family in his estate brought a lawsuit, again, under constitutional provisions and state law claims. But they also brought an ADA case saying that these officers should have been trained to accommodate people with disabilities, and they should have modified their policies to accommodate people with disabilities. There was a motion to dismiss filed by the state, and the court found for Mr. Saylor's estate, and the court said that, you know, courts have this implicit duty to train. There is this implicit duty to train officers about how to interact with people with disabilities. The state had argued, well, how can the ADA possibly put us on notice of all accommodations for all disabilities? And the court said, well, that's not what we're looking at here. I mean, we've got this very simple, logical accommodation, just to follow the advice of the caregiver to just hold off, let the situation diffuse. Let's wait a couple minutes for this individual's mother to show up. And that would have been the most logical accommodation. But instead, the officers weren't trained to make any modifications, and so they didn't, and this is the tragic result that happened. So that was a motion to dismiss, and then just a couple of weeks ago, the court also denied, in most part, the state's motion for summary judgment. They allowed the failure to accommodate case to move forward, although they did not allow the failure to train case to move forward. There's another example of this Boobin case about a failure to train or modify policies. And in this case, it was the same sort of situation where you've got a policeman arriving at the scene where someone is, there's an individual who's he's throwing things off of a balcony. The police enter his room. He's nude, covered in blood, and he is not able to follow the officer's commands. And he later explained he wasn't able to due to his impaired mental state. And so the officers see this individual who's not responding the way that the officers expect someone to respond, and they tase him two different times. He falls off of a balcony. Well, the court also in this case, you know, there were claims, all sorts of claims, but the ADA claim was about whether or not the officers, you know, should have been trained to recognize signs of someone who has mental illness or another disability, and whether they should have then been able to modify their policy and handle the situation more peacefully. And the court allowed the plaintiff's claim to move forward, denying the city's motion for summary judgment, saying that, yes, the city should have these policies to recognize and reasonably accommodate individuals with disabilities. So again, we've seen these two cases showing that the courts recognize this failure to train case. And the Broadwater case is another case where the court recognized a failure to train. But, you know, courts are divided on this issue as well. And there's other cases finding that failure to train is not a recognizable cause of action under the ADA. So the Buchanan case says that there was a claim that, yes, there was training, but the training wasn't sufficient. And the court said that's not a viable claim under the ADA. Same thing with the Sanders and the Tao case. There were cases where the court said, you know, we're not going to even make a decision on this issue. And then other courts have said that you know, to have a failure to train claim, you have to have some sort of additional violation of the law. So it's another issue that I think we definitely want to stay tuned to, because it's something that we're going to get more guidance on in the future. So I'm going to wrap up with this one final case, and that this, you know, so far all of the cases that we've discussed are cases about affirmative measures that police or law enforcement officers need to take. And we're going to end this section with the case alleging a more typical type of discrimination, when someone's just simply treated differently because of a disability. And so in this case, the Jones case out of the Eastern District of Michigan, we have Ms. Jones and her companion, and they were pulled over by a policeman for a broken taillight. And when the officer approached the car, he smelled a very strong smell of marijuana, and the plaintiff was able to show that she had an expired medical marijuana license. It seemed like they had a pretty good rapport at that time. They were joking back and forth, and the officer said, you know, no problem, I'm just going to like search a few things, but I'm going to let you guys go, it's no issue. As he's searching, he discovers that the plaintiff takes some medication. He asks what this medication's for, and the plaintiff says that she has HIV. Well, at that point, everything changed. The officer became very upset. He made a number of comments, including a comment that was something you needed to tell me. I want to make sure I put gloves on. He then ended up citing the plaintiff for having marijuana, and he gave a ticket to the plaintiff's companion for the broken taillight. And what's helpful in this case, if you're litigating it from the lawyer's perspective, is that the officer actually said, if it wasn't for this HIV disclosure, I don't think I would have wrote anybody for anything, but that kind of aggravated me. And so there you've got this clear indication of the sole reason why these individuals were given tickets. As kind of expected based on that statement, the court found for the plaintiff and denied a motion for summary judgment, allowing the case to move forward, and said that in this case, the facts that the officer issued the ticket, there were facts that showed that the officer was issuing this ticket really due to the plaintiff's HIV status. Shortly after this decision, the case settled for, I believe, $40,000. And so again, just another way we're seeing disability and policing play out in the courts. So with that, I think we're going to hold questions, and Barry will go next with ADA and correctional facilities, and we'll do questions at the end.
Thanks, Rachel. Actually, so far we don't have any questions. There was a comment that I think is helpful. I'll pass along. Someone said a takeaway from the Sheehan case is to consider whether or not the officers created the exigent circumstances themselves, and thus CIT training. Crisis intervention training is a key to understanding behavior. And so we're not going to really get into a lot of the techniques that are available to bring folks down, but CIT is certainly one that's been used by law enforcement across the country and has been deemed to be very effective. So now we're going to switch to cases involving people with disabilities in the correctional system, as opposed to just interacting with law enforcement. And we need to start just to make sure that everybody's clear on how correctional facilities fall within the ADA. You know, after the ADA was passed, there was a question on whether Title II of the ADA applied to correctional facilities. And the Supreme Court resolved that for us in the Yeske case in 1998. The underlying facts were that we had an inmate with hypertension who was denied admission to prison boot camp. And if he had been able to participate in that program, he would have been able to have early parole. And so he sued under the Title II of the ADA for being excluded because of his disability. And the district court found that state prisons weren't covered by the ADA. And the plaintiff appealed it up to the Third Circuit, which reversed and found, yes, they are covered by the ADA. And ultimately, the Supreme Court agreed to hear this. And I think in one of the few unanimous United States Supreme Court decisions involving the ADA, they found in favor of the plaintiff here and resolved really any dispute on whether Title II applied to state prisons. And the opinion was actually written by Justice Scalia. And the court held that Title II of the ADA does apply to public facilities and made sure that It was clear that that's defined as any department, agency, or any instrumentality of the state, which includes state prisons. So that resolved that issue, and in fact, there had been a previous decision that reached the same result regarding the Rehab Act on prisons, the Bonner versus Lewis case out of the Ninth Circuit in 1988. So this decision was consistent with the Rehab Act. So the general accepted position is that correctional facilities are covered by the Rehab Act and Title II of the ADA. We also wanted to just quickly note that one law that we're not going to spend a lot of time on that people should be aware of if they are assisting prisoners with disabilities in any kind of litigation effort is there is another law out there called the Prison Litigation Reform Act, or the PLRA, that was passed in 1996. And it has a number of provisions that limit how you can litigate as a against prison systems, but one of the main thing to make sure people are aware of is that prisoners do have to exhaust administrative remedies before filing in federal court. We wanted to review a couple of sort of classic examples of people who have disputes in prison because of architectural access. The Pierce versus City of Orange case, County of Orange case, is one that I think folks may have heard of. It got a lot of press back when it happened, involving a group of pretrial detainees with disabilities who had been housed in county jail facilities and had been unable to access a variety of things, including bathrooms, showers, sinks, and they were also denied access to various educational, rehabilitational, and recreational programs. And then a later case out of Illinois, the Jaros case, had a similar type of scenario, except this was in the prison context instead of the jail context, but you had a plaintiff here who used a cane for mobility. He also had was unable to access various aspects of the prison, including the shower, and there weren't grab bars and a variety of other things. And what was interesting in this case is that the IDOC recognized there were problems, but they refused to make the facility in that he was currently in accessible. But then he said, well, how about transferring me to a different facility that does have ADA access? And they said, we're not going to do that either because you're not going to be incarcerated long enough to meet our criteria for transfer. So the plaintiff was really caught in a catch-22. Bottom line in these cases is that initially the trial courts both found for the defendants and found that they were not violating the ADA, but upon appeal, both the Ninth and the Seventh Circuit found that architectural access barriers can be a basis for a Title II claim, and they found for the plaintiffs in these cases. The next case takes us a little further, the Clemens versus Dart case, which is a case that just happened this year, and I think it's one to watch because it kind of pushes the envelope a little bit, I think, on litigation with respect to people in correctional facilities. Here you had an inmate who was a double amputee who used a wheelchair, and even though the Cook County Jail and the hospital where he was going to had accessible ADA compliant cells, he was not assigned to one of those. There wasn't one available, and they were refused to move somebody out and move him into one. And so as a result, unfortunately, of the fact that it was inaccessible regarding the sink and shower and toilets, he ended up trying to transfer to a shower on his own without the grab bars, and he suffered personal injuries and ended up suing, including suing under the ADA. And the sheriff said, well, you know, there's not really a violation here because he could have used our nursing staff to help him access the facilities and that nurses were on call to help him when he needed help. And the court said, you know, that's not enough under the ADA. On-demand nursing support is not equivalent to providing an accessible cell. And the reason they said this was, I think, a pretty progressive view. It said that that would reduce the plaintiff's ability to engage in independent living to the fullest extent possible. What I think is interesting here is they're talking about independent living in the context of somebody being in a correctional facility. It's just something that has not been seen as much. And what the court did was they took this concept of meaningful access that we've seen in other contexts and said that meaningful access means that you have to have proactive affirmative accommodations to make sure that people get what they're entitled to, and that meaningful access here was to be able to ambulate independently and to access these different components of the jail independently rather than being reliant upon a second person. And the judge said, you know, the jail really got this backwards. The defendant was required to provide non-discriminatory access and the plaintiff was not required to request assistance. And even though the plaintiff didn't file a formal request for an accommodation, they said that he had an obvious need, and therefore them failing to provide assistance or accommodations other than the nurse was deliberate indifference, and they found that he could go forward with his case. A trial was actually held earlier this year in August, and he received a $95,000 jury award. The case was appealed to the Seventh Circuit, so it's not over yet, but the initial view is from the trial court and from the jury was very positive for the person with a disability. The Wright case also talks about additional reasonable modifications that are involved, and again take this sort of this pretty progressive view on what should be done for prisoners with disabilities. This is a case out of New York and involved an inmate with cerebral palsy and scoliosis, and he could operate a motorized wheelchair, but not a manual wheelchair because of his disability. And so, and this was a motorized wheelchair that had been prescribed by a doctor and paid for by Medicaid. So this was something that wasn't he was doing just for his own convenience, but something that the doctor said he needed. Unfortunately, the Department of Corrections had a blanket policy that said that no motorized wheelchairs were allowed, that it was a safety risk. And so he sued under the ADA saying this policy violated his ADA rights, that it wasn't an individualized assessment. And the court agreed and said that it did violate the ADA. And what was interesting here is New York took sort of the same approach and said, look, we know he can't independently ambulate with a motorized or with a manual wheelchair, but what we'll say is he should be able to use other inmates to assist him. They called them inmate mobility aids. And they said the problem with that is that really puts it in this intention with the ADA's emphasizes on independent living. Again, talking about being more independent within the correctional facility context, which is an unusual type of approach here. And one of the reasons they said that, you know, that wasn't a great solution to rely upon other inmates is those were unreliable and ineffective. Oftentimes, he missed meals and sick calls and doctor's appointments because the other inmates just didn't come through when they were supposed to. And he was kind of put in a catch-22 because, you know, he wanted to do this on his own. And when people were supposed to help him, they didn't. He was afraid that if he reported them, he would be seen as a snitch. And so it was really a terrible situation for him. And the court recognized that it was a terrible situation and, again, talked about that they were not providing him with meaningful access, and they raised that again. Interestingly, over 30 states allow motorized wheelchairs, which I think also helped find that that what the state was doing, the safety concerns they had weren't realistic, given that other states had done this successfully. And the Reeves case is a similar kind of case involving a prisoner who was being denied opportunities for physical access to the outside. It's a really sort of tragic case in that he had not been able to go outside for 16 years, and they had said for security purposes it wasn't safe to take him out. He no longer could sit in a wheelchair. He had to be brought out on a gurney, and they said he would be too vulnerable outside with other inmates. But they didn't explore other alternatives where he could go out on his own or with other inmates that had disabilities or were in solitary confinement. And so because they didn't really make any effort, and because it was such an extreme deprivation based on this supposed security concern, they found in favor of the plaintiff here. The Henderson case is a case I think that's really important because it resolves sort of a long-standing issue. Back in the 90s when I worked at Lambda Legal and worked on behalf of people with HIV, there was an earlier iteration of this case out of Alabama that went a different way. But since the 1980s, Alabama had a policy to segregate prisoners with HIV and AIDS. And the previous case that I'm referring to back in the 90s upheld this policy. And you know, one of the reasons it was upheld was because everybody who was getting HIV and AIDS at that time, most of those folks were dying. And so it was seen as almost a death sentence for most people who got that virus. And what they said at the time was, well, you know, direct threat is significant risk of substantial harm, but here the substantial harm is almost certain death, and therefore we don't necessarily need to get up to the significant risk stage. And so they modified the direct threat type of approach there and found that even though there may not be such a threat, a risk of substantial harm here, because the harm was so big, they were going to uphold the segregation policy. But ultimately, some plaintiffs challenged that policy in the 21st century, and this time they were successful and said, you know, things have changed here, and it's no longer a death sentence, and so we're not talking about such a substantial harm as it was before. And they also said that, you know, restricting people categorically, having these blanket policies without individualized assessments contrary to the ADA, they were limiting, you know, people with HIV from a variety of things, including substance abuse programs, food service jobs, claiming that they would, you know, potentially infect other people if they worked in food service. And they said, you know, the science doesn't support that. There really isn't any risk at all, much less a significant risk. And so they found that this policy was no longer valid. The new twist that they added here, which I think is most interesting and kind of goes to some of the issues we talked about before, is they also referenced the Olmstead case and said that the segregation policy was also segregating people contrary to the ADA of having people in the most integrated setting. And so an interesting twist that we're not just talking about direct threat here, but also the ability to get services in the most integrated setting pursuant to the Supreme Court's decision in 1999 under Olmstead. So that policy is no longer around as a result of that case. And a similar case was brought by the Department of Justice earlier this year against Nevada for their policy. They issued a letter of findings, and I couldn't find online whether there's been a resolution yet or not of this, but they laid out a lot of the same sort of concerns about this segregation being problematic, breaching confidentiality by identifying people who are HIV positive, and the stigmatization that comes with that. And so their remedy they are suggesting is abolishing these policies and training their employees and inmates on HIV transmission. So it'll be interesting to see how Nevada responds to this letter of finding from the Department of Justice. Another big issue that comes up in correctional facilities is effective communication in prison, and oftentimes this involves people who are deaf and hard of hearing. And the Pierce case is one that I think is a significant case to look at, an individual case. This was involved a deaf gentleman who was incarcerated for 51 days, and he was never assessed by the prison folks as far as his need for communication. And they assumed that writing notes and lip-reading was enough, but as the court ultimately said, American Sign Language is not the same thing as English. And even though he had asked many times for interpreters for a variety of reasons, including for some specific health reasons, he was HIV positive and had some complex health issues, he never got a response by the defendant. The court granted summary judgment for the plaintiff, and one reason why this is a significant case is we rarely see summary judgment for the plaintiff, which means there are no contested issues of fact, and they rule on the law in favor of the plaintiff. Usually it's the defendant that's seeking summary judgment. But here the plaintiff sought it and was successful in getting it, and found that the prison did violate, as a matter of law, the ADA in Section 504 by failing to accommodate him. And it was really two issues. One was the failure to assess the needs of the deaf inmate. And what's important here is what we put in red type. Prisons have an affirmative duty to assess the accommodation needs of inmates with known disabilities. So they don't, prisons can't just say, we're going to wait until we get an accommodation request. If they perceive somebody as needing an accommodation, they have an affirmative duty to reach out there. And the court talked about how this affirmative duty is more pronounced in the prison context because of the unequal power dynamics that are involved. The other violation, as I alluded to before, was not providing the requisite interpreter. And they found that he did need an interpreter. They said that the fact that they thought, they reasonably believed that he understood them was not relevant because he kept asking for it, and that ASL and English weren't the same. And they also failed to show any kind of undue hardship or fundamental alteration to provide the interpreter as requested. Another effective communication case in prison is one that we at Equip for Equality are handling along with our co-counsel, Uptown People's Law Center, the National Association of the Deaf, and the law firm of Winston & Strawn. And this is a class action case involving deaf and hard of hearing inmates. And our allegation is basically there's ineffective communication for folks who are deaf and hard of hearing in Illinois prisons. There's a lack of visual alarms and notifications. They don't have access to TTYs or other ways to phone out, hearing aids and batteries and other auxiliary aids. And in this case, it was the defendant who sought summary judgment, saying that there were no contested issues of fact. And the court disagreed in last year and found that the case should go to trial, and they granted the case as a class action. And, you know, in the complaint that we listed, we talked about all the different things people are deprived of when they don't have effective communication, including religious services, disciplinary hearings, medical services, mental health services, rehab programs, educational programs, and vocational programs. It really, you know, runs the gamut. And this case will likely go to trial in 2017, so one to keep up with as well. The Bearden case I'm not going to go into, but is another case involving deaf and hard of hearing prisoners against a county jail. And that case there was a partial summary judgment where they found that some of the notifications the county jail had not provided effective accommodations for when they were giving verbal announcements, but that there were questions of fact regarding TTYs and interpreters. So another one to watch as it moves through the litigation process. Oops, sorry. And then sort of as technology evolves, so do what plaintiffs are seeking. And the there were recent agreements out of Maryland and Kentucky. You'll see a link at the bottom by cases brought by the National Association of the Deaf and the Washington Lawyers Committee talking about the importance of getting video phones as a way for people to communicate outside of prisons, as well as some other provisions that were in both of these agreements, visual notification of oral announcements regarding emergencies, of course, access to interpreters and other auxiliary aids and services, and you'll see a link at the bottom for those two summaries of those two agreements. A huge issue that's been really, I think, in the news a lot lately is the issue of solitary confinement in prison, especially for those who have mental health issues. And in fact, earlier this year, President Obama issued a statement and called on DOJ to look at this whole issue of solitary confinement in federal prisons. And DOJ actually put out a report that might be interesting to folks who are interested in delving into this issue a little bit more. And while they didn't say that solitary confinement was categorically something that needed to be prohibited, it talked about how it needed to be used rarely and applied fairly and should have, you know, reasonable constraints. Folks who are interested in that report, you can find it at www.justice.gov/restrictive-housing. But generally, many advocates contend that the whole correctional facilities environment are far too frequently placing people with mental illness in solitary confinement. And in fact, what the results of often happens is people who go into these situations, their mental health conditions get exacerbated in a very horrible way. And apparently, the statistics are showing that about $100,000 people in the United States are in solitary confinement, and many of those are folks who have mental health diagnoses. We also have a link to a policy document that the ACLU put out on this issue as well. There's been a number of litigation that's going on, the Rasho case that we handled, I'll talk about in a minute, and then also Department of Justice has issued a statement of interest in another case going on in California involving youth with disabilities who were denied educational services while in solitary confinement. So if you're interested in that, there's a link there that will show you DOJ's position in that case. As I alluded to before, the Rasho case is one that Equip for Equality is handling along with two pro bono law firms, Denton's and Mayor Brown, and another organization, Uptown People's Law Center. And you know, in Illinois, we just have a really horrendous situation with respect to how people with mental illness are treated in our prisons. It's really a deplorable situation. And when we filed suit back in 2007, there were a whole host of issues, including a lack of adequate treatment, unmonitored use of psychotropic medication, a punitive approach towards people with mental illness, physical and verbal abuse by guards, and then, of course, as I alluded to before, significant use of solitary confinement. And won't bore you with all the details that went along with that case, but ultimately the case settled at the end of 2015, and some significant changes are included in that agreement. One of the things that Illinois really doesn't have is a hospital for prisoners who need inpatient services, and so that is going to be constructed under the agreement. The other thing is that there just was a real inadequacy of staff, both an inadequacy of clinical staff as well as security staff. And one reason why security staff is important for this is oftentimes they would say that people with mental illness could not go out of their cells and go out of solitary confinement because there just weren't enough security folks available to take them out of their cell and so that they could experience life outside that that segregation. And so by hiring more clinical staff, we'll get more mental health support, but also for new security staff, it'll allow people with mental illness to have more access outside of the solitary confinement. There'll also be construction of four new residential treatment units. We are anticipating a drastic improvement of treatment systems, which we found woefully inadequate, and then, of course, a significant reduction of solitary confinement. another case involving mental health in prison, you have class action cases, but important individual cases as well. And the Wright case, I think, is a good example of a really great individual case, a really tragic one, unfortunately. But this is a case involving a mother who sued the Texas Department of Criminal Justice after her son took his own life in prison. He ended up hanging himself from a ceiling grate. And he had severe bipolar disorder and schizophrenia. And what's so tragic about this case is that the prison folks knew about this guy's high-risk suicide status. He had had past suicide attempts, and they really did nothing about it. They could have come up with some accommodations, like providing him with a roommate. Instead, he was in solitary. Or they could have put him in a cell that didn't have tie-off points, given his past suicide attempts. And the prison, when Texas, in response to the ADA suit that was brought, said, well, you know, it's really tragic what happened to this person, but, you know, this is not a case of ADA discrimination. This is not a plaintiff who's excluded from prison programs. We didn't do anything wrong. He didn't ask for any accommodations. We shouldn't be held liable under the ADA. And the court said that failure to make these accommodations in a motion to dismiss could constitute discrimination under the ADA because the lack of accommodations caused him to ultimately to commit suicide and or prevent him from took away any kind of prevention that could have prevented him from committing suicide. The point I think that's important here is that while the facts were sort of unclear whether he actually requested the accommodations of a roommate or a cell without tie-off points, the court said that really didn't matter because the defendant was aware of the disability and his history and took no action. And the failure to take action really was where they ran afoul of the ADA. So the next issue I wanted to cover is the issue of the ADA and reentry. And this is kind of an emerging area, but we wanted to make sure you're aware of it because of it. It's something that seems to be on the cutting edge of what some folks are doing using the ADA for. And the reason why reentry is important is that the statistics show that 95% of people who are incarcerated eventually reenter the community. And what's problematic is that the quality of discharge planning and services really is sometimes incredibly inadequate. And as a result, when people are reintegrated back in the community, they don't have access to the appropriate public services they need. Oftentimes we see a decline in their mental and physical well-being. And of course, the most tragic thing is there is recidivism or institutionalization because of the lack of adequate discharge planning. And DOJ, we have a link there at the bottom of slide 57 to the DOJ Bureau of Justice Statistics, which give some background on the reentry trends in the United States. Now, the sort of the leading case or one of the initial cases on this issue is actually not an ADA case. It was brought under state law and the New York Constitution, but it sort of is the basis for some future cases that have been filed. In this case, you had inmates who were challenging the city's failure to provide inmates with mental illness with any adequate discharge planning services. Basically, they gave folks, when they left the facility, only a few dollars and no referrals to mental health treatment. And they claimed they were denied access to psychiatric medication and services needed to transition into the community. Ultimately, the case settled. You have a link there to the settlement. And what the settlement provides is that inmates who spent 24 or more hours in the New York City jails were given access to psychiatric treatment and discharge planning services, including a mental health assessment, case management, access to medication and prescriptions, and so on. And so that's a major change in New York's policy. We're now seeing these kinds of cases using ADA as a basis. And the most recent case is out in Los Angeles, U.S. versus Los Angeles County. The procedural posture here is a little confusing, but hang with me on this one, okay? So what happened here was the United States Department of Justice, they filed a complaint under a couple of different statutes, not the ADA. One's called the Civil Rights of Institutionalized Persons Act, and the other is the Violent Crime Control and Law Enforcement Act. And it raised a variety of issues regarding concerns about the Los Angeles County Jail. But there was one provision in there about discharge planning, and some individuals intervened to challenge the settlement, saying that portion of the agreement, they really were intervening on behalf of one paragraph of the agreement, that part of the agreement was really inadequate. It did not provide meaningful discharge planning for prisoners after they left the county jail. And so the county said, well, you know, this really isn't discrimination. We're treating all inmates equally. We're discharging everybody the same. We're not treating people with disabilities worse than others. And the court, and they sought to get out of it through a motion for judgment on the pleadings. And the court allowed intervention and denied the defendant's motion on the pleadings and let the interveners continue to litigate that they should be able to influence this agreement with respect to discharge planning. And in finding that, they found that the lack of adequate discharge planning disproportionately impacts people with disabilities. And so what we have here is an ADA violation because it has a disparate impact, an adverse impact on people with disabilities. And another component that the interveners raised is that in the settlement agreement, when people were being discharged, some of them, instead of being discharged into the community and community supports, were discharged to a mental health institution called Institution for Mental Disease, which are nursing homes where the primary diagnosis is more than 50% of residents with mental illness. And so what was, I think, sort of groundbreaking in this case is that it wasn't just about discharge planning, but also where you provided the services. And again, the Olmstead case has been raised in the correctional context in a way that we haven't seen before. And so that's going to be something I think that we look as the court, this case goes forward, and talking about not only what kind of discharge planning people receive, but also where they're receiving it. Are they receiving it in the most integrated setting as the ADA and Olmstead require? The last reentry case we want to talk about is an individual case out of Vermont that's also still pending involving a plaintiff with a schizoaffective disorder, and he also had autism and ADHD. And what was problematic here is he was supposed to be discharged, but he was not discharged for an additional 2 years because they could not find him a place, services and appropriate placement in the community because of his disability. And because he was being treated significantly differently than people without disabilities who were released 2 years earlier, the court had found that he had raised an appropriate cause of action. Ultimately, the case had settled in 2016. But the thing we wanted to make sure people were aware of is that while this case is involving people with mental disabilities, this kind of issue can come up in a variety of contexts with different disabilities. For instance, we're litigating a case right now at Equip for Equality involving somebody who was unable to be discharged to a halfway house because it was physically inaccessible to him as a person in a wheelchair. And so, you know, these discharge planning issues and access issues can arise in a variety of contexts. And then the last thing we're going to talk about, and then we'll open it up for questions, is the issue of the ADA and criminal proceedings. And what we're really focusing on here is access to the courts. And before we get into the details of what we want to talk about, we want to make sure people remember that there was a big Supreme Court case on this, Tennessee versus Lane, involving access to the court. You might remember these were involving two people who used wheelchairs. One was a court reporter who couldn't get into certain courtrooms, and the other was a criminal defendant who couldn't get up to the courtroom that he was supposed to appear in because it only had stairs. And they sued under Title II of the ADA seeking damages for the courtroom inaccessibility. And the state had argued that you can't bring cases against the state under Title II because the state is immune to money damages under the 11th Amendment. They have sovereign immunity. And the Supreme Court, even though they had ruled previously that you can't sue the state for employment discrimination under Title I for money damages, that you can sue for money damages for lack of court access. And they talked about the reason was because of this history of discrimination of people with disabilities in interacting with the criminal justice system and the court system. And so they were allowed to proceed with their case. The court didn't say that you can sue the state under all Title II cases. They really focused on lack of courtroom access. So one of the things we're seeing in the lower courts are different issues being raised and whether there's this history of discrimination to allow you to bring money damages suits in other Title II cases. But we're clear that you can bring it with respect to lack of court access. The thing that wasn't so clear, though, and why we have the Crackle case here, is what about people who aren't actual litigants or witnesses? What about people who are observing court proceedings or maybe are family members supporting their family member and need access? And the Crackle case raised that issue. as to whether does Lane extend to the public or family members. Here we had a plaintiff who was deaf. He used ASL as his primary language, and his mother was a criminal defendant, and she wanted him to be at court with him, to court with her, to provide emotional support and also to better understand what she was going through. And he had requested interpreters many, many times and was not able to get those requests granted, or oftentimes they were ignored. And there were a variety of different pretrial proceedings, a fact-finding hearing, a sentencing hearing, and even a hearing to address his request for a sign language interpreter. And the court, the state, and their position was two things. One is they said, you know, only defendants or witnesses are entitled to interpreters, not members of the public or family members. And also that these hearings were not really judicial services because they weren't part of the formal trial proceedings. And the court disagreed with both of those arguments and found for the plaintiff here and said the ADA applies to all government operations and that any public judicial proceedings is a judicial service. And so you don't just get accommodations for trials, you don't get accommodations just for witnesses or for parties, but also really for any judicial services going on, and it applies to members of the public as well as to family members, which the plaintiff was able to show here. Just to move on with the end of the case is just one of the things that the court relied upon is some of the language out of Title II, which actually specifically says a public entity shall take appropriate steps to ensure that communications with applicants, participants, members of the public, and companions with disabilities are as effective as communication with others. So it was clear here that Title II should not be limited just to witnesses and to the parties in the litigation, but also others who are wanting to observe this. And so we now see the Prackle and Lane case taken together to firmly establish that people have with disabilities have a right to participate in every stage of the criminal proceedings. As Rachel mentioned, a lot of times when these cases are brought, we see a number of claims brought, ADA Rehab Act claims, and then also claims under the Constitution, whether it be the First Amendment, Fourth Amendment, Fifth Amendment, Eighth Amendment, or 14th Amendment, as well as some other statutes that are out there. And we're not going to really get into that, but it's just important to recognize that a lot of times there's a lot of different types of claims that can be brought, and it's often good to put in as many claims as possible. Given the way courts go, you never know which way it's going to play out, and it could be helpful to raise multiple claims. So this last slide is just reiterating some of the things that Rachel said, you know, how important non-discrimination in the field of criminal justice is, especially given some of the law enforcement issues that have been in the papers lately, as well as some of the segregation that we've talked about, and how interesting it's been to see that the ADA has been applied in criminal justice situations in a more pervasive way than we've seen in the past, and in a more creative way, especially in using the Olmstead case as far as integration and independence of people with disabilities, which is a concept the ADA supports, but not one we've seen in criminal justice until more recently. So with that, why don't we open it up for questions? Here's the slide for continuing legal education. You can just email me if you're an Illinois attorney at barryt@equipforequality.org, or you can contact Great Lakes if you're a non-attorney and need participation education credit. And you'll also be receiving a session evaluation, so feel free to give us feedback on this session so that we can take that into account for future sessions. Rachel, I know you've been able to maybe watch the questions a little bit closer than I have. Is that okay for sending anything?
Sure, I'll go through some of them. There was one question. Many people may have heard of the case about a month ago, 2 months ago, where an individual in North Carolina who was deaf was killed in an interaction with law enforcement, and the question was whether we had an update on what's happened with that case. I actually tried to find an update and didn't see anything. Everything I saw was just about the initial event. I didn't see any case being filed, but if anyone else who is participating in this webinar has any information, feel free to add it in the chat bar and we'll read it to everybody. Another question I see is, will these slides be available to attendees? Yes, absolutely. Both the slides and the legal brief will be available on the www. www.ada-legal.org website, as well as a recording of our presentation. The slides may already be up, but if not, everything will be up tomorrow.
And I do see one question. I'll just jump in, Rachel, if it's okay, about, you know, we've mostly been talking about cases involving adults, and our question is, would this apply to youth with disabilities in juvenile prisons? And we had one case, the patient A case, involving kids in juvenile justice facilities, and I think it's there's no legal difference between people who are youth as well as people who are adults and their rights under the ADA. So even though some of the cases we talked about involved adults, I think similar arguments would be able to be made for people in juvenile prisons.
There's another question that I think is a really complicated one. So I'm going to give my best answer and then see if Barry has anything to add. But the question is, do police enforcement have a right to know or question someone about their disability if their disability is not otherwise relevant to the needed accommodation? And I think this question comes from the Jones versus Lacey case where the driver was asked what the medications were for, whether or not she has had to disclose that, and whether or not maybe in a situation with a service dog, if they're denied access, did the police have a right to know the disability that requires them to use a service animal? So I guess a couple of thoughts. I mean, thought number one is, in a typical interaction with law enforcement, I think, you know, law enforcement is subject to Title II, which DOJ has some pretty clear guidelines about what can and cannot be asked about service animals. You know, that said, I think when you get to a point where something's being investigated, so for instance, if an individual has been pulled over and there's some sort of discussion or inquiry into the legality of some sort of drug, I mean, I think then you're kind of going outside of the scope of an ADA disability inquiry and more into a criminal investigation. And so it is something you would likely have to respond to. But I think it's hard to kind of give general guidelines because it seems like that would be a very, very fact-intensive type of inquiry. And I have not seen any cases on it. Barry, I don't know if you have any differing thoughts.
No, that makes sense to me. And I think, you know, this is another situation where you might have an interplay between the ADA and some other claims. So there, you know, obviously we have the Fourth Amendment regarding unconstitutional searches and seizures and those types of things that may be more relevant involving the situation than the ADA, or there may be ways to play them together. There's a question here that talks about a person who's a deaf resource specialist and how challenging it can be sometimes to get interpreters at court, and what should you do, who should you talk to? I mean, remember that courts are Title II entities, and Title II entities are required to have a self-evaluation plan and a transition plan and should have some sort of an ADA coordinator. And you know, a lot of times courts do have somebody who's the point person for ADA issues and accommodation requests. Other times it's something that's done in a more you know, spread out fashion or non-centralized fashion. But I guess what I would recommend is a couple things. One is to ask if there is an ADA coordinator and then to go to that person and find out what the process is for requesting an interpreter. Another good way to find out information is to check on the court's website. That's something that we've been working on in a variety of jurisdictions in Illinois to make sure that information is available on the website for issues of accommodations, including interpreters. So those are a couple things that come to mind.
I'll just add one thing. In Illinois, there's been a push to actually designate someone as like the courtroom accessibility coordinator in all of the state courts. And it was something that I think the state worked on to try to get in place. And so, you know, for those advocates out there, I think it's a great model to follow to if you want to do something like that in your state, we could pass information along.
So there's a question. Are you aware of any cases outside of effective communication that addresses inmate claims of not adequate quantity or quality of equipment related to disability provided by the Department of Corrections? I mean, I know that I've seen some situations where people have needed some different tools that are related to their disability, and oftentimes those cases have come down to issues of whether the thing that they're seeking, whether it be a cane or like a blind person who needed an awl to type out Braille, that kind of thing, whether there were security issues or not. And that oftentimes is one of the reasons why there may be a denial of equipment that is requested. And so, you know, I think one thing we didn't really touch on too much today, except sort of tangentially, is that, you know, the correctional facilities are a different animal, and this whole issue of security is something that courts can sometimes be deferential to. Now, we saw some cases, we highlighted some cases where some of the correctional facilities were sort of using security as a knee-jerk response and not really doing individualized inquiries and seeing whether it really was a security risk. Remember the one involving the motorized wheelchair, whether that was a security risk, or having the person go outside on a gurney, whether that was a security risk. But, you know, there are a lot of cases out there where they will say we can't provide this kind of equipment or that kind of thing, and the argument they'll make is that it's a security risk. So I think to the extent people with disabilities and their advocates can argue why it wouldn't be a security risk or what kind of alternate options might be available to prevent any kind of security concerns, that's really one of the more important things to do in those kinds of cases.
I see questions asking the same. Individual who asked about who to contact about interpreters in the courts. The question is the same question, but with respect to the prison setting. So remember that both courts and prisons are subject to Title II. And so they're going to have that requirement that Barry just talked about to have a designated ADA coordinator. And so most correctional settings, you know, should have someone who's designated to be that ADA coordinator. Sometimes that's their only job, sometimes it's part of their job in addition to other things. But if you call or look online for information for the correctional facility, and again, look for that ADA coordinator, that should at least be a good starting point to get you to the right place.
And what we've seen in Illinois through our Holmes case that we talked about is that there's somebody's designated over the system, and then there may be individuals at each different facility who's sort of maybe not the ADA coordinator, but maybe the point person to handle those kind of inquiries when they come up. And of course, you know, the training and the resources that those kind of folks vary across the country, and some of them can be very effective, and some of them really are in name only and are not doing much to help people with disabilities. So it really does vary jurisdiction by jurisdiction. We have any other questions that you saw, Rachel, that I missed?
I think it's everything I see. Oh, okay. I see a new one. In the Sheehan case, we mentioned CIT. What does that stand for? Barry, I think you did a nice job explaining what that was. Do you want to do that again?
It's a crisis intervention training. So this is a training that is an in-depth training for a variety of folks, including law enforcement, on how to handle a crisis and what type of techniques are effective when interacting with people with mental illness who are experiencing a crisis, and so that people go in equipped to address, you know, concerns. And it's an in-depth training that requires, you know, a significant amount of time, and there's sort of a short version and then a longer version, but the longer version really gives folks some great tools to de-escalate the crisis and to be aware of what's going on with the person with mental illness so that, you know, some of the tragic results we've seen in other contexts don't happen.
I also see a question about what is a site for Bonner versus Lewis, and that site is 714-SUP-420, and it's the District of Arizona, 1989.
You know, okay, and I have Rachel, I've got a Ninth Circuit citation, so I don't know if it got remanded or what, but the citation, okay. We'll give you both, and then you guys can look it up, is 857F2nd559, and that was that 1988 Ninth Circuit decision. So this is the one that's basically the Rehab Act looking at the applicability of prisons. Since we got a couple minutes, one thing I just wanted to sort of reiterate that I think is really important is just sort of how the ADA in other contexts are being applied into the prison context. And I mentioned the Olmstead decision. When we really think about that, typically we think about that as housing for people with disabilities moving out of traditional institutions, but now we're seeing that within prisons, and then when people are getting discharge planning, when we talked about that sort of thing, as well as, you know, the Henderson case as far as people with HIV being segregated, and then the U.S. versus L.A. County and the discharge cases. And I think it just shows how you can be creative in how to use one case that's relevant in one context and be used in another, as well as the meaningful access. I mean, we've talked about on these webinars before meaningful access being used in other contexts, like in voting, where people who are blind, you know, the ability to vote independently and privately is what meaningful access is, not just the right to vote, but to be able to vote independently and privately. And to now see that within the prison context, to be able to ambulate independently as being meaningful access to the prison programs, I think is really just something that I really wasn't anticipating, but I think is a creative way to apply some central core concepts of the ADA in Title II in the criminal justice context. And I think it's just making, you know, better access for people with disabilities, which I think in the bottom line is really a great development. And the only other thing that I skipped, just because I didn't want to run out of time, is there was a case that we ran across that talked about a private prison and whether you can bring a Title II claim for that. And it's a pretty, you know, limited issue, and I just want to let people know that there is this one case that's out there that we found, or that Rachel found, I'll say, Edison versus Duberly. It's Edison versus Duberly, Duberly. And the citation is 604 F3rd 1307. It's an 11th Circuit case out of 2010. And at least that court found that private prisons were not covered by Title II of the ADA, or covered by Title III of the ADA. And I think that the challenge here is, in these cases, is to sort of figure out how the person got there. So I think if a state is placing somebody in a private facility like that, it's akin to the Olmstead cases where the state is placing people into private institutions. And so I think there are still good arguments. I think DOJ would agree that you have good arguments under Title II that state, whether you place them in your own facility or in a private facility, you're still going to have ADA obligations. So I wouldn't let that case discourage me from suing under the ADA for private prisons, but just recognize that that adverse case is out there. And I think we're at the bottom of the hour. Claudia, if you want to take it from here.
Thank you very much, Barry, Rachel. And if anyone still has questions, you can go ahead and either contact your local ADA center by calling 800-949-4232, or you can email Barry and Rachel, which I believe they put their contact information at the beginning of the presentation. Or you can send them to the Great Lakes ADA Center at webinars at ada-audio.org. And we'll make sure they get the questions. Today's session is being recorded. It will be available around this time tomorrow at the ada-legal.org. If you have any questions regarding certificate of attendance, you can send those emails to certificates@adaconferences.org. With that, we'll conclude today's session. Thank you to our presenters, and thank you everybody else for joining us today. Have a good afternoon. To exit the platform, just click on the X in the upper right-hand corner. If you're on the phone, you can just disconnect.